This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Did President Bush ask either O'Neill or Lindsay to resign?
Yeah, I've answered it as directly as I can. The individuals resigned, as you know.
Is that a yes or a no?
The individuals resigned, as you know.
So are you denying that they were asked to resign?
I've answered the question, and that's what I intend to say about
it. You haven't answered the question.
The individuals, as you know, have resigned.
That's White House spokesman Ari Fleischer playing peekaboo with the press on Friday, responding to questions about the resignations of Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill and Economic Advisor Larry Lindsay. The announcement of a personnel shakeup in the White House economic team came the same day that the U.S. Labor Department reported disappointing unemployment figures, the worst in nearly a decade. Dan Schor joins us now. Good morning, Dan.
Hi, Scott.
And, Dan, I suppose given given the economic news, are we surprised by these resignations, or the timing at any rate?
Well, it's only the timing that is surprising. It's been widely known since about last June that President Bush wanted to shake up his economic team, didn't plan to do it before the midterm election. Clearly, the president does not want to be in the position his father was in of getting a lot of kudos around the country as a great war leader and then losing re-election because of perceived inattention to a lagging economy.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, do high-level resignations like this signify a change in policy?
Well, chopping off heads is one way of signifying a change in policy, even if you're not sure what the new policy is going to be. Secretary O'Neill had let it be known, you know, one of his big problems in the White House was his penchant for letting things be known. Mm-hmm. O'Neill had let it be known he didn't think that a big economic stimulus package at this point was a very good idea. Lawrence Lindsay, also a little more outspoken than was good for him. For example, he shocked a lot of people in the White House by saying that an Iraqi war might cost a couple of $100 billion. You know, a cardinal sin in politics is committing truth, and these two fellows committed truth.
Mm-hmm. What do we make of the fact, though, that despite the news of the resignations, or maybe because of it, this disappointing unemployment data, and despite an impending bankruptcy filing by United Airlines, the stock market actually rose yesterday?
Well, it was very funny that the market started dipping on that surprising 6% unemployment figure and started rebounding on the news that Paul O'Neill was also unemployed, right? It certainly underscored how O'Neill had long since lost the confidence of Wall Street as these spokesman for the administration, and they decided to simply acknowledge that and say, all right, you don't like Paul O'Neill, we'll give you somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Mr. O'Neill, I think, saved wisely, too, near as we can tell. So shouldn't be totally at odds. Listen, of course, the breaking news from Iraq this morning, we're actually getting a look at that 11,720-page declaration of weapons that Iraq is going to make within a few hours formally to the United Nations.
I understand that they can look but not touch.
Yes, that's our reporter Annie Girls on the scene, and others have been told that. Government spokesman says this will demonstrate, I invite you to certify, we have no weapons of mass destruction. What happens next?
Well, first of all, this may sound odd, this whole massive report, which is incidentally in the form of CD-ROMs, just to show you how modern they're getting, first of all, it has to be checked for confidential material. Now, why would their report have to be checked for confidential material? Because of the possibility that in the course of spelling things out, they will provide information on how you make weapons like that. In mm-hmm. order not to help weapons proliferation, you have to be able to cut out the stuff that is confidential. Then it goes to the UN Security Council members, and assuming that there is no confession in there to weapons of mass destruction, and I'm sure there isn't any such confession, then the ball essentially comes back to America's court. The White House has been insisting it has a solid basis for saying that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, has not yet shared that information with the UN inspectors, and at some point, if the thing is to move from there, somebody is going to have to tell somebody something.
Mm-hmm. Reading between the lines of what have been said by the U.S. and British governments, what do you think they know and what they intend to do with that information?
Well, the British released a report in September already listing specific amounts of chemical warfare agents, specific precursor chemicals, that is, chemicals that can be turned into weapons, and the growth media for production of biological weapons. Whether the United States knows something more than the British have already published, I don't know. But clearly the administration wants the Iraq report out first and then plans somehow to challenge it.
The Bush administration has been underscoring for the weapons inspectors that they have the power to facilitate what could be seen as the defection, at least a prolonged visit,
yes,
of prominent Iraqi scientists and their families outside of Iraq to provide testimonies as to what stores of weapons might be there. I guess they've even talked about a witness protection program. How is this plan actually supposed to work?
Well, that's a very interesting part of it. First of all, a witness protection program is maybe the way to refer to it. What happens is that if you get these technicians and scientists, they may well be the key to whether current programs and current sites can be identified or not. That becomes a very important thing. The way it's supposed to work is that the inspectors ask them to leave Iraq with their families where possible, and I suppose maybe spirit them out of it. I don't know whether they're going to abduct them. I don't know. How this exactly is supposed to work, I don't know. But the idea is to get them where they can be interviewed in safe places and then would be under American protection and care.
This week, Iraqis have once again fired on U.S. and British warplanes patrolling the no-fly zone. That's been happening for the past 10 years. The attacks, however, are continuing at a time of great sensitivity as the weapons inspections are resuming. Are we seeing something more than just every side trying to assert their right?
Well, I think as with the case of getting these scientists out, that along with what happens in these no-fly zones may well be important for what happens next. You know, for the past 10 years, American and British planes have been patrolling these so-called no-fly zones, protecting the Kurds in the north, protecting the Shiites in the south. Iraqi ground defenses every once in a while fire back at them. They fire back at the radar station, at the ground defense, and that's been going on. But lately, the Bush administration has been saying something, that the attacks on these planes constitute a material breach of the UN resolution all by itself. Now, since those are the code words for what justifies an invasion, if the administration says that these attacks are material breach, I think they're beginning to raise the ante a little bit, as though they're building up the case for invasion, which will not rest alone on whether or not they can prove their weapons charges.
This week, an internet site claiming to represent the Al-Qaeda terror network has declared that the Al-Qaeda terror network, which is not a cable channel, intends to launch attacks against Israel in the West Bank and Gaza. If this is the case, perhaps it already is the case, how does this complicate the political landscape there?
Well, Al-Qaeda was linked to the bombing of an Israeli tourist hotel in Mombasa, Kenya, and then trying to shoot down an Israeli plane with mobile missiles. This was a departure from what looked like the policy of Al-Qaeda before, which was targeting Americans, American institutions, World Trade Center, and so on. And it's just a kind of a further development of what you might call the indivisibility of terror, that all terror in the end comes together in a kind of a globalization.
Voters in Louisiana are at the polls today, if they choose. Democratic incumbent Senator Mary Landrieu trying to fend off a challenge from the Republican Susan Terrell. Polls indicate that it's just about notched up even, if anyone believes polls anymore. How important is this election to both parties?
Well, it's certainly symbolically important. It would once again mark a victory for the president who's been down there campaigning. Secondly, it would shore up the Republican majority in the Senate, giving it 52-48. And in the third place, symbolically, it would be the first Republican senator from Louisiana ever.
Okay. Thanks very much, Dan Shore.
Right.